This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. Voters in seven states will choose their Democratic nominee for president tomorrow. Much attention has focused on the contest in South Carolina, the first southern state to weigh in on the race. The South has played an important role in the development of the Republican Party over the past 50 years, causing a few political analysts to recommend the Democratic presidential candidates skip the South altogether. Some are proposing an alternative strategy, a focus on the Southwest and the growing influence of the Latino vote. But in truth, tomorrow's contests are literally all over the map. Tiny Delaware on the East Coast, sparsely populated North Dakota, Missouri in the heartland of the Midwest, and in the Southwest, Oklahoma, Arizona, and New Mexico. So how does a candidate tailor his message when trying to appeal to so many different regions, often with competing interests? And just how important is geography to national elections? This hour, we'll explore how and why place defines how we vote. Later in the program, we'll talk about Super Bowl antics and the coarsening of American culture, but first, geography and politics. Does where you live affect how you vote? Have you moved from one place to another and found your political views changing? How much are your values and beliefs about politics connected to where you live or where you work? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address, TOTN@npr.org. First, we want to get a snapshot of tomorrow's primaries and caucuses as they shift south and west. With us from his office in Annandale, Virginia, is Rhodes Cook, a political analyst who focuses on voting trends. His new book is called The Presidential Nominating Process, A Place for Us. Welcome to the program, Rhodes.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Now, the political buzz is saying South Carolina is the most important contest for the Democrats tomorrow. Is that the case?
I think South Carolina is the most important in terms of drawing attention because it has something of a history to it on the Republican side. It's been very important, particularly to the Republicans over the years, ending with the Bush-McCain contest in 2000. What a pivotal role it had there. I'm not sure it'll be all in all that telling this time around, because we have votes taking place, as you mentioned at the beginning, in all regions of the country. And this vote tomorrow is really not a southern test, as it is something of a mini national sampler, with bits and pieces of the whole country weighing in for the first time in the nominating process.
What's different, though, about the southern voter? Is there something different about the southern voter that really separates it from other regions of the country?
Well, I think there is, particularly if you look at some of the recent studies by the Pew Foundation. You tend to think of the southern states as being more churched than other parts of the country, particularly to the north. Also probably a bit more hawkish than the rest of the country on national security and foreign policy questions, and a bit more conservative on social values. But there's also a large minority population of African Americans, and increasing population of Hispanics. It leavens the mix, probably not enough to make it a very favorable region for the Democrats in 2004, but may change the political equation as we move through this decade.
Now, some analysts are looking at the contests in Arizona and New Mexico with the predominance of Latino voters in those states, and they're really saying this should be called Hispanic Tuesday. How significant are those races, and how different are they in terms of their regionalism from what you've just described as the southern vote?
Well, when you get out to the far west, you're getting into a part of the country which is really very much in the developing stage. It's evolving before our very eyes in terms of its demographics. The Hispanic population is going up quickly. There's also a large retirement population, particularly in Arizona. It's a part of the nation, really, which is up for grabs, I think, in the 2004 presidential election, much more so than the South. So it bears watching, even though the results from New Mexico and Arizona will weigh in a little later in the evening tomorrow night. It'll bear as much watching as South Carolina.
What might we learn from results in those elections about what might happen in the national race? Is there anything we can
Yes. Well, that's a good question. In New Hampshire, we began to get a look at how not just voters in Upper New England vote, but voters in academic communities, in old mill towns, in suburban communities would be voting, particularly those communities along the southern border with Massachusetts. Now, on February 3rd, tomorrow, we're going to have some more constituencies weighing in, giving us a sample of what they feel about this presidential election, particularly about the Democratic candidates. I mean, we're going to have a large number of African Americans in South Carolina, in Missouri. It's kind of a mix of cities, suburbs, small town America. The Southwest, as you mentioned, will be a strong Latino vote, and as well as a Native American vote, as well as some large cities such as in Phoenix, Tucson. So we're going to begin to get a much wider look at the whole American mosaic of voters on February 3rd, which will be interesting, beginning to fill in some pieces of the puzzle about where the candidates are running well. As well, I think another thing just to look at, Lynn, is just the size of the turnout in these states tomorrow. We know that in South Carolina, for instance, there were nearly 600,000 voters who participated in the Republican primary between Bush and McCain. Will the Democratic turnout tomorrow come anywhere close to that? I think that'll be an interesting side question that we'll have to look at.
I want to ask you about the red and blue map that people have talked about so much since the 2000 presidential election. Red, of course, standing for Republican, blue for Democrat. A lot of political pundits and players sort of divide the United States into red and blue states. Now, you talk about this electoral map as the Republican L. What do you mean by that?
Well, I look at it a little differently, and I think it's a bit more geographically coherent than red and blue America, which has some states in each region maybe belonging to the other camp. I would say that the Republican base in America now is geographically an L, which includes the South on the bottom right-hand corner of the L, if you visualize a map of the United States, and including the plain states of the Midwest and the Mountain West, filling in the upper portion of the L. This is about half the country, and this is where the Republicans have built their majority in presidential, House, and Senate elections.
And how would you define the cultural and political similarities in that L region, or are there similarities, or are they disparate?
Well, I think there's some disparateness in terms of being churched and unchurched. But I think there's a similarity in terms of relatively negative attitude toward big government programs, probably a hawkish nature and approach to foreign policy, a feeling of hostility toward the inside the Beltway crowd, so to speak, and probably an embrace of what we might consider small-town American values.
Okay, if there's a Republican L, what is there for the Democrats? What's left?
Whatever's left.
Does it form a letter?
No, unless it's kind of some type of Sanskrit or something. Looking at the map, it's the Pacific West, and then you jump over and you take in that swath of states from the Northeast west through the industrial heartland. So it's what's left over. It does not quite have a distinctive shape to it as that Republican L, but it's about equal in size and voting strength to the L.
And they, too, are voting on issues that are specific to where they live?
I would say that they are a bit more urban in nature. The suburbs are a bit larger in the Democratic portion of the map, a bit more secular, maybe a tad more affluent than the Republican L, and also generally less churched, less ardent churchgoers than you would find, particularly in the South.
We're talking about geography and politics on Talk of the Nation today. The number 1-800-989-8255. My guest is political analyst Rhodes Cook, and we're going to take a call from Ben, and he's calling us from Texas, I believe, Houston. Hi, Ben.
Hi. How are you doing today, Lynn, Rhodes?
Pretty good. Have you recovered from the Super Bowl?
yes, I did. It was a pretty quiet one for me. My wife and I are just starting the second trimester.
Oh, good. Congratulations. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, I'm calling you from Texas, and I guess I would consider myself part of the New South, having gotten here in kind of a wayward path, and from California, including 12 years in Alaska, with a winter in a log cabin, and then going to graduate school in Colorado.
Have you found that your politics have changed as you've moved around the country?
They have somewhat. I was very ardently and actively involved in the Democratic Party up in Alaska, worked on some state house campaigns, and actually spent a couple of years working for a state house member for a state legislator up there.
And are you still a Democrat, or have you changed your political affiliation?
I am still a Democrat, and have been pretty active in the primary process, working, donating and spending some of my time volunteering for one of the campaigns. And
Ben, you've moved from Alaska to Texas. Have you seen real regional differences in the way people view politics as you've moved through the country?
Yeah, yes, I have. It's very interesting, and in Alaska is a very, if I can say that, a very polarized kind of political environment. You've got a very active, energetic base for I guess both sides of the left and the right. Though typically that kind of splits out on a rural and urban breakout, and then also sort of a conservation versus development kind of axis.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Ben.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Rose Cook, very interesting call, because I think that Ben represents a very typical American at this point. Americans move around a lot and move from West Coast to East Coast, from North to South. So how much does regionalism really affect their vote? Do they vote the way the people in the place where they were born and raised vote, or do they vote where they live?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it deserves more study. I think there is an assumption that you're affected by your environment that you live in and the voting habits of the people around you, but by nature, if you're a bit more contrarian or an individualist, you're going to vote as you did before. And it was interesting he talked about a new South. That's reminded me, I guess, of my initial point about how the demographics are changing in the South that could change the political complexion of the map. But I would go beyond that as well to add that the demographics are changing everywhere, and that while this Republican L I talk about and the regionalism you're talking about is there's a snapshot we have at the moment of this, as the years go by over this decade and into the next, it'll constantly be evolving and changing, and it may no longer be an L at all, but some other letter of the alphabet.
Well, in this 2004 election, are there any shifts occurring, states that are up for grabs?
Because of demographic changes?
Yeah.
Yes, I would think across the lower part of the Sun Belt, particularly at the ends, Florida and Arizona, Nevada, those states where there is a continually growing Hispanic population, which is in turn raising the Democratic vote ever gradually, I think that could weigh in and be a hidden factor in this 2004 election.
And what do you think is going to be the most important region in this race?
Well, in terms of a battleground, I think it would be the industrial states from Pennsylvania west to and including Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota, though they're not exactly all industrial, but that swath of states from Pennsylvania west to the Mississippi River and just across, I think will be very important. Plus the three we were just discussing, Florida, Arizona, and Nevada, will be interesting to watch to see if the Democrats do have a chance, because all three of the latter states are now part of that Republican L, and all three of them voted for President Bush in 2000.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Lynn.
Rose Cook is the author of The Presidential Nominating Process, A Place for Us. We're talking about political geography. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about political regionalism and what role, if any, it plays in our political beliefs. Does place define how you vote? Call and tell us how and why. The number is 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. With us here now in Studio 3A is James Gimple, a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland and author of Patchwork Nation, Sectionalism, and Political Change in American Politics. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we've been talking about the intersection of geography and politics. In your view, how important are regional sensitivities in presidential politics today?
Well, I think they're very important still. I do agree with the earlier sentiment expressed by Mr. Cook that maybe the South is slightly less distinctive than it has been in the past. But we still have very intense geographic differences in politics at the local level and within states, across counties. The South is still probably the most distinctive region in the country, but Southern sectionalism matters less than it did, say, in 1950 or certainly in 1870.
What are some of the other values that you would associate with different regions of the country, apart from the South, let's say the West?
Well, look, geography matters because people socialize each other, and they socialize each other or they influence one another's views through discussion around certain values. And often you find at the bottom of a geographic pattern in politics something like a distinctive economic interest. This might be water in the West, or oil and energy production, or timber and forest products in the Pacific Northwest, mining and extractive industries. So often these are economic foundations that we see at the base of, say, partisan sectionalism as you look at differences between Republicans and Democrats on the map. Other times it's political ideology, uneven percentages of liberals and conservatives. We think, for instance, of the San Francisco Bay Area as the nation's preeminent focus of politically liberal thinking. We also, of course, think of New England and particularly Massachusetts in this way. The Republicans think that they can tar John Kerry, in fact, with the liberal Massachusetts moniker, and they probably can. Other times, sectional differences in politics are traceable to religion. The South, for instance, as a bastion of evangelical Protestantism. But I think a better example might be the Mormon or the LDS Church that's made the politics of Utah so distinctive. Or, indeed, the split in the state of Idaho between a Mormon-influenced southern part of the state and a less Mormon smokestack or panhandle part of the state. So there are all kinds of foundations for sectionalism, but I think they're primarily rooted in economic interests, political ideology, religion, perhaps race and ethnicity to some extent.
Is there an issue that you could identify in this year's election that is particularly associated with some kind of geographic trend? And I would say go to a sort of the intersection of economics and geography, that there's an issue that you could identify.
Well, you know, my impression is that campaigns are often insensitive to geographic variations. They don't seem to have strategists with sufficient local knowledge about what really matters from place to place. And that's, of course, because local knowledge is very costly to obtain. So what you hear the campaigns hammering on are these rather vague, simple themes that they think apply universally. War in Iraq, jobs in the economy, better schools, health care, same old thing, day in and day out. Again, most campaign consultants don't have local polling data or local information that would really help them to understand how regions matter. If you take a look at a typical national poll, for instance, it's going to consist of 800 to 1,200 voters, and it's not going to represent states and localities very well. A typical poll might include maybe a smattering of 80 voters from Florida, or 12 from Nevada, 15 from Oregon, 20 from New Mexico. But those tiny numbers aren't really going to allow you to understand the New Mexican electorate, or the Nevada electorate, or the Florida electorate. So for campaign pollsters who are trying to give good advice, their polls just aren't going to speak to these regional differences.
Well, how does a national candidate tailor a campaign that encompasses regional differences, speaks to regional differences, and yet maintains their national outlook?
Well, I think the campaign, a good campaign, needs to actually spend some money to commission some state-level polls, at least in some battleground states. Again, it's costly to do that, but it would yield much more accurate information about local needs and interests that you could then insert into a stump speech as you sort of tailor that stump speech from place to place. Also, by the way, many campaigns are in the habit of dissing or devaluing local political operatives who have spent their life in places like Columbus or Billings or Des Moines. These people know every single single neighborhood, these locations, and yet the campaigns want to dictate to those folks on the ground rather than have the locals dictate to them. So that arrogance, I think, is a real hindrance to running an effective, regionally sensitive campaign.
We're talking about politics and geography. The number here, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Gregory, who is in San Diego. Hi, Gregory.
Good morning from San Diego. One comment I would make is that, in a sense, geography does have some impact. Where we are does matter, but I think who we are matters even more. First, I would just say that California, being at the west end of the country, after the primary season, we almost have no choice because everyone else has been screened out. We may only have one candidate, if we're Democrats, to choose. But anyway, on a very specific issue such as immigration from Mexico and amnesty and questions like that, it's an issue here. But if you're an Anglo-American, an English-speaking American, you are likely to have one position, as in contrast to a Mexican American who may have been, whose family may have been here for generations, or who may be a first generation Mexican American. There may be people in New York State, in New York City, who are very much in favor of increased welfare spending, whereas in upstate New York, they couldn't give a darn about what happens in New York City. So geography matters, but in a very more minute sense. I think regionalism is passe. I think the sense of solid South, we've become such a mixed salad, and there's so many hot button issues that you can't generalize in terms of regionalism anymore.
All right, thanks for your call, Gregory, and I'd like to hear Professor Gimple respond.
No, I think the caller makes some good points. Broad regional identities are clearly not as important as they have been in the past. And what you need then to do, if you really want to understand how geography matters, is go down to the local level, to localities within states. And understand sub-state sectionalism, for instance, Eastern Washington along the water is going to be very different from, Western Washington along the water, got my directions confused here, will be very different than Eastern Washington out around Spokane, or how Eastern Pennsylvania and Western Pennsylvania are very different from each other. Those are the kinds of regional identities that still matter and indeed may even be more intense than ever. But it is true that I don't think the South is as distinctive as it has been in the past, and the caller makes a good point.
Okay, let's take another call from John, and he is, he is in New York. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
I would like to make almost the same point as the previous caller. My opinion really is that this whole discussion is much more socially generated. When you look at people, baby boomers, people in my generation who are professionals now, we have transplanted ourselves around the country based on where the jobs were. And I think the influences on our voting decisions, frankly, are much more social in nature. The Kennedy assassination, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, things of that nature which influenced us as young people who were determining what our political bent was going to be, mm-hmm. I think play a much larger part than where we happen to live these days.
Professor Gimple?
Well, the age distribution varies across the country from place to place, from county to county. In suburban New York, for example, you're going to have a lot of young people who are maybe in that 18 to 29 age bracket, whereas in a different location, you might actually have more baby boomers. One of the things that's not widely known about the South, for instance, is that outside of Florida, it has a very youthful population. And one of the reasons why turnout is low in the South is not just because of low-income minority voters in that region, but also because it has a very youthful age distribution attributable to young family-age migrants.
Because I teach the history of American government at a university in upstate New York. And in fact, I start my first class by asking, how many of you 18-year-olds are registered to vote? And typically, it's one-third. And I find that they just don't care.
Yeah.
So that's a whole different discussion, however.
It is. Thank you for your call, John. And I want to follow up on your call with Professor Gimple by asking, I mean, when you're talking about what is influencing a voter, geography is one thing, economics is another, age is another. So there's a sort of a hierarchy of influences. Where does geography, where do you think at this point, how important a role is it when you compare it to some of those other things, class, race, economic situation?
Well, again, I think regardless sometimes of economic interests, political ideology, race, ethnicity, and religion, what you're talking about with geography is the effect of space or distance, the fact that people live within proximity to each other. You know, that tends to matter. Sometimes you see commonality of views simply because people exert pressure on each other to conform to some common attitudes or ways of thinking about politics. So in a particular location, regardless of whether you're a lawyer or a clerk or a laborer, you might have very similar ways of viewing politics because the distance or proximity and the social interaction taking place in the location where you live imposes certain values. Look at border cities, for example. Take some places like the suburbs of New York, which are in three separate states, or places like Lewiston, Idaho, and Clarkston, Washington, that are on the border. Now, on an everyday basis, you might not notice differences in and among those populations, but below the surface, there are huge differences based on the fact that those various suburbs lie in different states with very differing political traditions and histories. And so, again, it's distance, accessibility, a space that and boundaries that make a huge difference to, you know, whether a location will cause a particular kind of political attitude or viewpoint to develop.
That last caller also touched on something which relates to something that's come up a couple of times already in the program, and that is the fact that Americans now are so mobile, that they move so much, and yet they take with them whatever it is that the values were, perhaps, or the social influences they had as they were growing up. How do you suss out how much a person is voting on what they were raised with as opposed to what now surrounds them in the community they've decided to live in?
Well, I think that's a fascinating topic of study, and there actually have been some studies on this. And most of the studies suggest that when people move, it actually de-aligns their political preferences. They become less intense when they move from one context to another, say from Massachusetts and their company transfers them to Arizona. Very different political context in Arizona. They don't change their politics completely, but their politics becomes sort of less intense. Their ideology becomes watered down by their mobility. There are very few people that will, you know, completely realign as a part of a move, but their political preferences may actually be altered or watered down a little bit. They may actually become more independent in their political thinking. One of the reasons, in fact, why the Western states have had such a long history of independence, political independence, is because that is the region of the country that has the highest level of mobility.
We are talking about politics and geography on Talk of the Nation. My guest is James Gimple. He's a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. His book is Patchwork Nation, Sectionalism and Political Change in American Politics. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And, of course, you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call now from June, and she's in Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, June.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Traverse City is up in the north part of the Lower Peninsula, right along the Great Lake of Michigan. Very scenic, lots of tourists. And here in Michigan, one of the biggest concerns after that of national and homeland security is the loss of good jobs. And, of course, in Michigan, that means a manufacturing job. Up here, in particular, we have a lot of service jobs and working in restaurants and that kind of thing. And, of course, they don't pay well enough to keep a person raising their family adequately. So I think among people up here, among the Democrats and Republicans dissatisfied with the current administration, people are very much wanting a change and wanting somebody who's electable.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, June.
Thank you.
I think June, one thing June is touching on there is what we talked about earlier, and that is how the economics of a region sometimes is almost interchangeable from just the geography itself.
No, that's absolutely the case. And, you know, as bad as things might be in Traverse City, I have to tell you, they're much worse in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And they've been much worse there for a long time. They're probably also much worse down in eastern Michigan, where I think the residents there are very concerned about the future of the American auto industry. So, you know, even within the state of Michigan, you have these fascinating geographic distinctions and the intensity of concern about something like deindustrialization.
All right, let's go to Mary Beth, and she is in Massachusetts. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi there. How are you, Lynn?
Good, thanks.
The point I'd like to make is sort of the opposite of what most of your callers and guests have been saying. Is when I decided to leave Texas, I made the decision about where I was moving based on the politics of the area. I was only looking at areas that were going to be comfortable for me to live in around the issues of choice and gay rights.
So you were looking for a place where you would be politically comfortable?
Right.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Is that a trend, Professor Gimbel, that people actually are moving to places where they think they will be politically and socially comfortable?
Well, I don't think too many people do that in the sense that they look at a precinct map and they will study, you know, precinct by precinct, the variation in, you know, in Boston or, you know, Champaign, Illinois or San Bernardino County, California. But clearly there will be people who will prefer a certain kind of housing or they might have preferences for certain kinds of schools if they're family age, for instance. And that will often define or determine a certain kind of politics. But I don't think there are probably that many people who are sufficiently informed about local political variation that they would actually study, you know, a map and say, gee, I really want to live in a Republican area as opposed to a Democratic area.
All right. Thanks for your call, Mary Beth.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask you, Professor Gimbel, about the red and blue map that we talked about earlier, the reds being the Republicans, the blues being the Democrats, and the way people point to that map of this is how the country's going to go. It almost seems like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy to talk about the United States, to break it down into those two categories, red and blue. And I just wonder what your take is on viewing politics that way.
Well, it's clearly an oversimplification, and many of the callers have picked up on this. It might actually be more helpful if we were to display, say, a county-level map and see that there are a lot of nuances and subtle variations in the shades of red and blue within states, and that would be very helpful. Of course, you know, again, national network media are displaying these things, and the presidential candidates are, after all, competing for states, so I guess it's understandable that they're trying to characterize states more broadly. But I think geography really matters at a much more local level.
All right. And just really briefly, what region is going to play the most important role in this election, do you think?
Which region? Actually, I think Rhodes Cook is absolutely right. I think the upper Midwest, the states from Pennsylvania on over through Michigan, Illinois, I think those are going to be very critical states.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
James Gimbel is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland College Park. His book is Patchwork Nations: Sectionalism and Political Change in American Politics. Talk of the Nation from NPR News.